Take a network break. I'm Drew Conry Murray.
And I'm Jonna Johnson.
Help yourself to a holiday-themed virtual donut as we shake some boxes under the Christmas tree to see what news might fall out. Jonna, what are we covering today?
Well, we've got a couple of Red Alert security warnings, some announcements from Extreme and Nokia, and an awful lot of advanced chip news from Google, Apple, Broadcom, and more.
All right, everybody's getting chips for Christmas this year. Jonna, let's start with our Red Alerts.
So the first one is a remote authentication bypass that allows admin access to Ivanti Cloud Services appliance. To put this in context, there were 77 CVEs of CVSS 9.5 or higher that were published in the week ending December 11th. That's an awful lot of red alerts. We think one of the top ones is the level 10 authentication bypass exploit that was found in the Ivanti Cloud Service appliance, the CSA. Ivanti is supposed to be a secure communications gateway for Ivanti tools from customer networks to its cloud, but the exploit, which is 2024-11639, allows remote attackers to get administrative access without authentication. It affects CSA versions 5.0.2 and below. The fix is to upgrade to 5.0.3, and we've got a couple of links in there.
Now, I feel like Ivanti also went through the ringer earlier this year with some really bad CVEs. So it looks like they're back for another turn.
Yeah, and I am just not all that sure that people should be using them generally until they get their house in order. But that's certainly not a decision for me to make on behalf of our listeners, just something to draw their attention to.
Yes, and just to reassure you, we are not covering all 77 of those 9.5 or higher.
Yeah, we'd be here all day, right?
All day. Just one more before we get into the news. The open source wireless router OpenWRT has a pair of vulnerabilities, including a 9.3 rated software vulnerability. When used together, they can enable a supply chain attack that would allow attackers to provide malicious firmware updates signed with legitimate keys. The OpenWRT project has instructions for running a software upgrade to fix this. We've linked that in the show notes. So if you are using this just in a lab or even somewhere in production or at least on the public internet, you want to go take a look at that, grab the link in the show notes. But Jonna, you've got some even more cybersecurity news, although we're getting away from our CVEs.
Yes, well, I'll just wrap up. If you're going to be Googling it, that CVE is 2024-54143 if you need to search on it. There's a new Senate bill that augments cybersecurity requirements for telecoms operators in the wake of Salt Typhoon. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has submitted draft legislation called the Secure American Communications Act that orders the FCC, in collaboration with the Director of National Intelligence and CISA, to create requirements for cybersecurity measures to prevent unauthorized access to communications and call metadata. It further requires telcos to implement these cybersecurity measures to meet the requirements. Although U.S. law has required telcos to protect communications content and metadata since 1994 as part of CALEA, which is the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement, until now, the law provided neither specific guidance nor an enforcement mechanism other than requiring the use of switches that allowed the FBI and other agencies to break in. If the law passes in its current form, telcos will have to implement whatever the FCC in future specifies, test their systems annually for vulnerabilities, patch everything, and document everything they found, as well as contracting for annual independent compliance audits, documenting any non-compliance findings, remediating them, and wait, one more documentation, documenting the remediation. This sounds like a big fierce announcement, but my reaction to reading it was kind of like big whoop. You got to remember that telcos are publicly traded companies, and the SEC has put most of these requirements in place for public firms starting last year, which is right around the time we started finding out about Salt Typhoon, and I suspect, although I am speculating, that those two are related. Also, there's the question of how viable this bill is given the anticipated anti-regulatory mindset of the incoming administration. One of our analysts had said, well, the big difference with the proposed regulation is that the SEC is saying, make your own policies and follow them, which is fairly loose, where the Senate is saying, do the specific cybersecurity things the FCC says to do and prove you've done them. So it is meaningfully stronger. I don't know. Drew, what do you think?
This is kind of like the punishment you get where it's like, all right, we need you to keep your stuff secure. We're not going to tell you how. We're not necessarily going to make you jump through a lot of hoops and trust that you're going to do it. If you fail spectacularly, which it seems like the telcos have, that's when they start to turn the screws and say, all right, we're going to start making you do more documentation. I don't know what the FCC is going to propose. And you're right, given the new administration, even if this law passes, the FCC could be very hands-off with any cybersecurity requirements it puts in place. Frankly, I'd rather see, you know, recommendations coming from CISA than the FCC. I think they've got a better grasp on, you know, essentially best practices, which, God, if they're not doing that already, that's what they should be doing. So I'm kind of with you, big whoop. This feels more to me like something must be done. And so that's what we're getting.
But that said, if you work in the cybersecurity department of a telco, or you are one of the big name consultants that does these kinds of audits, that's probably something to keep in mind, keep your eye on for 2025 and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always, these kind of measures are always good news for security vendors, auditing companies, and so on. Whether it's actually going to lead to better security, I wouldn't bet on it. All right, let's move on to some product news. On December 9th, Extreme released Platform One. This is a management and automation platform that engages LLMs and other forms of AI to provide a unified platform for managing network and security functionality, plus licensing, inventory, and support. So it's going to include conversational, interactive, and autonomous AI agents. And these agents should work across your networking, your security, and your business teams. I got a briefing from Extreme, and they made a big deal about how this also incorporates business things. So for example, on the operations side, if the network ops teams gets an alert in a dashboard, they can click on an AI icon, and that'll trigger the AI to troubleshoot the problem and make a recommendation. They also say they'll have AI agents that work behind the scenes to provide anomaly detection and remediation. For instance, AI agents should be able to automate routine tasks like onboarding a new branch site. As I mentioned, Extreme is also touting this tool for the business side of the house, so procurement and finance teams. They say these teams will be able to get dashboard views into relevant information around things like subscriptions, licensing, your inventory, what spare parts you have, what you might need, and also they can perform tasks around adding, renewing, and managing Extreme contracts and licensing. So, Jana, a lot here. Any thoughts out of the gate?
Well, I think the first thing that I would highlight is I actually do think it's a fairly big deal to stress the whole business component, because it, in a way, what Extreme is doing here is sort of forcing via tooling the integration and de-siloization of two famously siloed organizations, you know, the networking tech side of the house and the procurement side of the house. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of organizations, what happens is a technical selection process that happens. The technical folks decided what they want, what they need, what they're going to be doing. Then they throw it over to procurement to negotiate, and procurement hasn't a clue. And that lack of clue continues going forward. So the procurement team comes back and says, hey, what, how many licenses do we need? What version are we running? And the network team has to go running around, you know, getting that for them. And here the procurement and finance teams can take a quick look. That's actually sort of super helpful. That said, Drew, I think you pointed out it's not really GA until next year, late next year, with no pricing details. I think it's farther along internally than they're necessarily making it seem for customers, but from a customer's perspective, it won't be real till you can buy it and kick the tires.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always a little suspect of AI announcements coming out of any vendor. To me, this announcement feels like, you know, partly a statement of intent from Extreme about this product release. It's meant to signal to customers and potential customers that they have an AI strategy. I think part of that signaling is to keep current customers where they are and not stray to another vendor also selling a beautiful AI story, and also maybe to lure potential customers in who are looking for a platform approach. I do think, as you mentioned, this is the first networking company I've heard talk about trying to integrate that procurement side of the house. So I do think that's potentially an interesting differentiator that Extreme could lean into. And I do think they have, you know, some of the pieces in place to actually maybe build out a functioning and capable AI system. Of course, there's always caveats with that, but they've already built out cloud infrastructure to manage your wired and wireless Extreme gear via the cloud, which means they have presumably a huge data lake. If they've done their modeling well, that's a lot of data they can use to train an AI and also potentially make it effective in an Extreme environment. This is definitely for me a wait and see, but I do feel like Extreme could actually pull this off, you know, again, with the big caveat, if they've done everything right.
Yeah, and I think to turn this into something actionable, if you are a current Extreme customer, get a briefing, ask all the questions you need. If you are considering Extreme, definitely ask questions around this, and maybe they'll tell you a bit more under NDA if you are interested.
Yeah, absolutely. Our other networking news for today, Nokia has announced it's going to support the open source Sonic Network OS on its data center switches. Sonic was originally developed by Microsoft and is now overseen by the Linux Foundation. Nokia will support Sonic on three platforms out of the gate, the 7250 IXR 10E for data center spines, the 7220 IXRH for leaves and spines, and the 7215 IXAI for leaf spine management. I will say Sonic is widely used by Microsoft in its cloud data centers and may have made inroads to other cloud and hyperscaler environments, not so much the enterprise. Nokia is quoting analyst firm 650 Group predicting that the market for Sonic data center switches will exceed $9 billion by 2028. It's a decent piece of pie that I think Nokia wants a slice of. Frankly, it's interesting to me because Nokia has been working hard to promote its own SR Linux network OS. Like Sonic, it's a Linux-based OS. Nokia is trying to make a push into the enterprise by touting the benefits of SR Linux. So adding support for Sonic requires Nokia to be getting into engineering support, marketing resources that might otherwise be put toward growing its enterprise presence. My assumption is that Sonic support was demanded from a large customer or potential customer. And just a few weeks ago, we discussed Nokia inking a long-term deal to provide Azure data centers with its gear. So I'm guessing this announcement and that one are related.
Oh, yeah. There you go. It's like, hey, Microsoft is a real supporter. Nokia is going to be supporting Microsoft. So therefore, they have to use the Microsoft tools. That said, I think it's probably a good decision. I cannot, obviously don't have insight into Nokia's true ROI here in terms of what you just mentioned, having to have the engineering and support for it. But if it's really true that we're going to see a $9 billion market for these switches, for switches based on Sonic, I think that compares, just in contrast to last year, the global market for data center switches was $16 billion. So obviously it's more than half the total from last year. That's a good chunk of change. And I've got to say, even if Nokia is going after it just for one customer today, it looks like there'll be plenty of customers in the future.
Yeah, and I will say that $9 billion is expected to be by 2028. So it's not right. $9 billion this year, but it's growth and vendors love growth. I will say, Nokia is kind of late to this party. White box vendors have been supporting Sonic for ages. Arista announced Sonic support back in 2020, and Cisco even also runs Sonic on a couple of its lines. So Nokia, again, a little late to the party, but they're here and ready to dance.
Exactly. Well, moving on to a bunch of news from the chip world. First of all, Google has been making waves with its new quantum chip that features scalable error correction. The buzz in the quantum computing space is all around Google's Willow chip, which is 105 qubits, which is respectable. And Google says can scalably reduce error correction requirements, which doesn't sound like a big deal, except that if you understand with qubits, they're inherently noisy because they don't maintain state very well. And so they generate errors, and those errors can propagate. So one of the holy grails of quantum computing is developing an approach that says throwing more qubits at the problem will reduce the qubit errors. And that's huge because that says you can bring the error rate down as low as you need it to by simply adding more qubits. Google says it has accomplished this with Willow, which uses logical qubits, which is one of approximately a dozen, depending on who's counting, different approaches to instantiating qubits physically. And just a side note, if you're wondering what the heck a qubit is, it's the equivalent of a binary bit in the non-quantum world. And the big difference is that it's not an either or, a zero or one, but it can be in multiple different states. And the challenge is it doesn't usually hold those states very long, which is part of where the errors come in. And Google has said, well, its qubits can hold state for approximately an hour, to the point where they've been having trouble finding the errors to look at them. So that could be some kind of record. This is a fairly big deal. And there is a little bit of bigger news that's kind of hidden in the wings of this, which is that Google is building out its own chip fab and is planning to build its own quantum chips in the not too distant future. And these will likely be based on Willow or its successors.
Huh, that is interesting because a lot of times they contract out to places like TSMC to get these things actually built.
Exactly. And one might question whether anybody's actually talking about working with Intel, which is building the futuristic stuff, as we've talked about. Of course, that may all change with the new CEO coming in. But if you're listening to all of this and going, what does this mean to me? If you're a network manager or an enterprise technologist, first, what it does, it's a major milestone on the timeline for broadly viable quantum computing. This is a fairly big deal because the error correction issue has been a major stumbling block, and being able to say the more qubits you throw at it, the lower the error rate, that's a huge deal. But even if you don't think that's a big deal because you're not going to be working with any problems that are quantum advantage, i.e. that need quantum computing, it also moves forward the timeline for the emergence of cryptographically relevant quantum computers, also known as CROCs. It's not exactly likely that Google is going to go launch an attack on your encrypted data using a quantum computer, but I wouldn't say it's out of the question that it would do so at the request of some government agency, depending on what country. So net, it kind of moves forward the timeline in which you need to be thinking about remediating your encryption to make it quantum proof. NIST has helpfully issued three algorithms, two of which were developed actually by IBM, that you could begin implementing now if you're worried about Google decrypting your data without telling you about it.
Yes, it also means we can presume that if Google is working on this, others as well are working on this outside the United States, entities that might be interested in cracking your data, not to get alarmist, but we do now have, supposedly quantum proof algorithms released by NIST. They are out and in the wild. I think we did a Packet Protector episode on it. We'll link that in the show notes if you want to get more details, but it is something to start thinking about. And I do think, Johnny, you're right that this does potentially move that timeline forward a little bit more than people were perhaps anticipating on when you need to be thinking about having quantum safe cryptography operating in your environment.
Yeah, because most people are kind of like, it's 5 years out. I don't need to think about that. I would say 5 years is kind of the far edge of what government agencies are projecting, and it could be as soon as 2 years out. And oh, by the way, if somebody is capturing your data and saving it, they can save it for 2 years, they can save it for 5 years. Storage is almost free, so.
Yeah. Right. There's also, this is what's being told to us publicly. We don't know what's happening behind the scenes.
Exactly.
Not to have my tinfoil hat, but just something else to influence those calculations. Moving on to other chip news, but sticking with Google, they've also announced the general availability of their Trillium TPU or Tensor Processing Unit. These are custom ASICs for training large AI models. They'll be used to power Google's cloud AI services for customers that want to train and develop things like chatbots, generate code or content, develop synthetic speech applications or other use cases. Rather than depend on third-party chips, Google's been designing its own TPUs for years. Trillium is the sixth generation of this TPU. Google calls Trillium a key component of its AI hypercomputer. This is an architecture that underpins its AI cloud services. Google says its AI hypercomputer can provide 13 petabits per second of bisectional bandwidth across 100,000 Trillium chips and scale a single distributed training job to thousands of its TPUs. Jonna, I'm calling this out because while it may seem like NVIDIA is the undisputed king of AI, it does have competition.
Yeah, and I think it's very significant that Google is getting into the chip design, and if we can believe the Willow News, chip fab space, because this is a fairly big deal. But that said, I think you had indicated that it looks like someone else is manufacturing the chip for Google.
As far as I could tell, this looks like a TSMC job for Google, so I didn't see anything in the announcement that I read about Google, fabbing these chips themselves. They're certainly doing the design.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's a very... Again, another forward-looking tactic that Google is taking, and in fact, the fact that Google's getting down into the hardware says quite a lot. Also, just a complete side note: if you don't know, Trillium is a really pretty three-lobed flower. So look it up; it's quite beautiful. I'm not sure how they picked the name, but
nice. One other note: Google saying that its ASIC design, which is designed for AI workloads, is superior to GPUs, which were, built for graphics and happen to be also applicable to the kind of computational work that AI does. I think at this point, very few people are worried about that distinction. They just need to get AI projects off the ground. I do think that as the industry matures, organizations may have to take more time to discern whether a TPU or a GPU is right for whatever job they're using. And that could eventually start to bite into NVIDIA's market. I don't know that Google's ever going to start selling these chips to third parties. I suppose it could, but I think in general, it means that for NVIDIA, one, they've got competition, which two, in the long term, means prices may start coming down.
Yep, completely agree. And then we're moving on to even more chip news with Apple and Broadcom. They're going to be partnering on AI chips. Apple has apparently tapped Broadcom to help it develop an AI processor for servers. And one of the reasons it's cited for the partnership is that Apple wants to reduce its reliance on NVIDIA processors. So sort of back to your theme, Drew, of NVIDIA's got competition here. Once again, looks like it's TSMC that's involved in the manufacturing of these chips. Any further thoughts on that?
No, I assume, for folks that are thinking about, AI as being critical to their business, like the hyperscalers, big companies like Apple, they may start to think more seriously about the benefits they can get of custom chips as opposed to going off the shelf. So again, yeah, just more competition on the horizon for NVIDIA. Also a win for Broadcom, which ties into our next story, which is Broadcom announcing its Q4 and full year results. For the quarter, Broadcom's revenues were $14 billion, up 51% versus this time last year, with a net income of $4.3 billion. For the full year, fiscal 2024, Broadcom had revenues of $51.6 billion, up 44% versus last year, with a net income of $5.9 billion. Now, if you're guessing that Broadcom's going to be crowing about AI as part of that revenue gain, you'd be correct, but that's not the only thing. Software accounted for almost half of Broadcom's revenue in 2024, coming in at $21.5 billion in revenue, up 181% versus 2023. I know Broadcom really made a lot of folks mad in the IT community for the way it handled the VMware post-acquisition, but it's also generated astonishing revenues. If that revenue trend continues, you can understand why Broadcom was willing to endure complaints and maybe why it took the actions it did.
Yep. And on the semiconductor business unit, the news is good, but certainly nowhere near as eye-popping. Full year revenue was $30.1 billion, up 7% versus last year. And the CEO, Hock Tan, says that AI contributed $12.2 billion to that total, and that AI revenue by itself was up 220%, driven by sales of its XPUs and Ethernet.
Yep.
Okay, I guess this may seem like one long theme of NVIDIA bashing. It's not intended to be that, but NVIDIA was hit with an antitrust investigation in China. China is now actively pushing back on Biden administration efforts to reduce export of the most advanced U.S. technology to China and has launched an antitrust probe against NVIDIA, specifically China's State Administration for Market Regulation, SAMR in English, has begun investigating NVIDIA's $6.9 billion acquisition of Mellanox from earlier this year. Mellanox provides InfiniBand interconnects that power more than half of the world's top 500 supercomputers. And separate note, China is tightening controls on the export of several elements critical to chip manufacturers such as gallium and germanium. This got a lot of news play last week because people were saying, oh no, these rare elements are going to be, you know, harder to get. It turns out that there are an awful lot of sources outside of China. So I think this is just all part of a general battening down the hatches and preparing for tariff wars.
Yeah, I don't know that China could do anything about the acquisition of Mellanox that already happened. This does seem to be, to me, an effort of by China to say, okay, US, you want to play hardball, we'll find ways to play hardball. One of the ways we'll do that is to launch lawsuits against, you know, sort of champions in the industry. Based on the US, NVIDIA is a prime target. So that sucks for the folks at NVIDIA.
Yeah.
But it's these days impossible to kind of separate out, you know, global politics from technological development.
Yeah, and this is of course the fundamental challenge with global supply chains. They do depend on goodwill outside the country, and certainly that's not always the case there. And we'll see how that evolves if the incoming administration just actually makes good on its promises to slap 100% tariffs on anything that's coming from China. And I think that kind of wraps up what we've got. Drew, where are people going to find you?
I'm on Blue Sky, Drew_CM. I'm also blogging at packetpushers.net. Jonna, how about you?
Best way to find me is at my company, nemertes.com, N-E-M-E-R-T-E-S.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm under my full name there, Jonna Till Johnson. And we would always love to hear from you. Please send us some follow-up. We love to read it. We discuss it, and we take it very seriously. So that's packetpushers.net/FU.
Yep, we always love to hear from you. Just a note, this is our final show for 2024. Thank you for being with us for a year of tech news analysis. We wish you happy holidays and a happy new year, and maybe a real donut or two to tide you over until the virtual donut shop reopens in 2025. Thanks for listening.